Josh Bell hates everything.
That's right, including your movie.
Josh Bell hates everything.
Except me.
Hello and welcome to the Josh Bell Hates Everything podcast. I'm Josh Bell, film editor for Las Vegas Weekly. And joining me this week is Jeffrey K. Howard of VegasFilmCritic.com and KVBC Channel 3 and other things, I'm sure.
KCLV. Channel 2 on the city, yes.
Oh, all right.
I've been on 10 years with them now.
So, very excited. When is your show on these days?
It's on Fridays at 10:30 p.m. and also Sunday at 11 p.m. So
cool.
I'm in reruns right now for the last two or three weeks because of the holidays, but new episode next week.
Very exciting. That's into film, right?
Into film.
Into film.
Right.
Awesome. Check Jeff out on TV.
Please do.
So, yeah, it is kind of a slow time.
This is always like a black hole for movies.
Because
after the Christmas rush and after the holidays and all of that and then the New Year's, it just seems like – you know, that's why I always take vacations or, you know, time off right after around that time because there's nothing going on or nothing coming out. I mean, not completely dead, but just, you know, it takes the first good 2 weeks of January for something to come out then. It's always
right.
They always dump bad films too. You ever notice that?
Oh, yeah.
January and February always are like dumping grounds. But then we have Sundance going on and some other things. So we have some hope, you know, coming out for later on in the year that we get some buzz and some info coming out of the film festivals. But, yeah, I always call this a wasteland, you know.
Yeah,
right now, so.
It really is. All these movies that don't screen for critics or, like, just crappy, you know, lowbrow comedies and horror movies and stuff.
Or movies that have opened, like, for award consideration, like for Oscars. And
right, they kind of trickle into.
They come in now to Las Vegas.
Right.
You know, like, great example, one of the first films we're talking about today. That came out, you know, weeks ago.
Right.
So it's, but yeah, it's just that it's kind of a weird time. It's these first 2 months of the year are always just kind of like, you never know what's going to go on. There's nothing set in stone and they're shuffling things and they're doing kind of weird things like that. But yeah, so I just feel lazy.
Yeah.
I
thank you for rousing yourself and coming in here.
I didn't know what time. I'm glad you emailed me. I'm like, wasn't I supposed to be there at 2 o'clock or what's going on? Then you're like, we're waiting for you. And I'm like, I'm literally on the freeway. I was going to the mall. I'm like, oh, I told my friend, you go. I'll be back later, you know. And they're like, oh, no problem. You know,
and so, you're here. So,
I am, so.
Well, the biggest sort of high profile thing that we're going to talk about for this week is The Lovely Bones, which, as you say, did open in very limited release, I think just in New York and L.A.
Right.
At sometime in December. And it was going to be a slower rollout, I think, but thanks to...
Well, they kept pushing it back in Las Vegas. I remember that.
Right.
Kept getting pushed and pushed, and now finally they say tomorrow, right?
Yeah, it'll be out here this week. But it's a nationwide release. I think what they ended up doing was instead of trickling into various cities over time, they just decided to, you know, blanket the country this week because the response hasn't been all that good.
This is one of Paramount's big films that they want to push, DreamWorks, that they're looking for award consideration. And I don't see it happening. Not because it's a bad film, but just, I don't know, just something about it overall doesn't click with me. I mean, I understand what the movie's trying to say. I understand the nuances, and I understand the dream sequences and Peter Jackson. And I mean, I understand everything that's going on, but it's just one of those movies at the end when I came out just going, I didn't feel moved.
No.
You know, I didn't come out going, you know, I know there's strong emotional scenes and there's just a lot of things going on in the movie, but it just didn't feel the sum of all its parts. You know, I just didn't come out feeling, wow, they've got a hit on their hands or, wow, they've got, you know, best actor here or best picture. But what they have is a movie that I just don't understand how to explain to people or who to recommend it to. You know, especially when you say it in the most simplistic form about a little girl who's brutally raped and murdered by a pedophile. And they're like, well, what do I want to see that for? And I'm like, no, it's the guy who did Lord of the Rings. Well,
right.
So, you know. So this is a really difficult film to describe unless you're a reader, I guess. And
it's based on a very popular novel. And
right.
But the thing is, I think you can say, oh, the girl was raped and murdered, but I never got the rape part of it in the film. I mean, I guess not in the book, and I haven't read the book, but that it's clear that she's raped and she's dismembered and it's very brutal. And Jackson kind of like
he implies
pulls
it.
Away from that. I wasn't sure.
Stanley Tucci implies that he sexually desires her. You could
yeah,
I've watched
but,
it more than once. And
yeah.
Not that I'm sadistic, but I've seen in his face, you know, if he was a killer, he would have kind of a madman look. He played it to where he looked like he desired her.
Well,
you know,
right.
That's how I saw it.
But it's done all by I mean, coming out of that movie, if you had asked me, do you think that character raped the girl? I would say, I don't know. I don't know if that's clear in this movie. And I think it's sort of emblematic of the way that the movie is kind of timid about that stuff, that Peter Jackson loves creating these sort of candy-coated afterlife images and the CGI and stuff, but he shies away from the more serious, weighty stuff, and that's why, like as you said, it doesn't move you.
No.
It's not emotionally affecting.
No, because there's so many special effects and there's so many times when the movie is starting to be heavy hitting, and it just it cascades you away to some dream sequence, you know, almost like Imaginarium Dr. Parnassus, you know, it's all of a sudden it's like we're gonna just do a dream sequence or just do a fantasy sequence, and it seems to kind of gives people a breather when I think it does the film disservice by doing all these yellow submarine kind of weird what dreams may come sequences. And I wish it was just a little bit more low key, and a lot of it doesn't make sense to me. I know it implies, you know, what's happening in the movie, and it's with her and what happened to the other girls that have been murdered, because she's like a Nancy Drew in the afterlife. She's solving her own. You try to say her name. I always mess up.
Oh, the actor. I think it's Saoirse Ronan.
Saoirse, is it?
I think that's how you pronounce it. Yeah, it's an Irish name.
Absolutely amazing performance by her. She's she's just absolutely stunning in the film, and you need an actress. A child that mature that can do something, can pull this off. But I just thought a lot of the dream sequences didn't add to the film because, it detached away from the heavy-handed subject matter.
And right.
I think Jackson used that to kind of like calm people down because they're like, we still got to sell this movie. It's a big budget, big.
Right, and I think that was almost the problem is that they spend all this money on special effects, and I don't think that's really what the story is about. I mean, I felt like it would have been almost more effective if you didn't have special effects. You could have stuck the actress, and she's an excellent actress, like you say. You could have put her on an empty soundstage with just a white background or something, and you would still get the same idea that she's in this sort of nebulous afterlife, and it's
minimalism is what it needed.
Yes, and Peter Jackson is not a minimalist in any way.
The sequence where she had a gazebo and it would turn into this whole thing, and I thought to myself, "Wow, that was a cool effect." I'm like, "But why?" It seemed like a $500,000 effect that just didn't contribute to the story.
Lot of it does really. It really doesn't.
Right.
And
but again, marketing for this film. Who are you going to tell to go see this?
They seem to be marketing it at teenage girls now. I was reading that. I guess that's been the biggest response in their test screenings or whatever. So they've decided.
Is it Mark Wahlberg? I don't know.
Maybe what it's about. I mean, the main character is a 14-year-old girl, and there's she has her little crush on a guy that she is about to get to kiss for the first time, and she gets murdered instead. But
it takes place in the early 70s.
Right, for no reason that I could figure out.
Yeah, I don't understand that either. Why
other than that, maybe the book's author grew up in that time.
Right.
But I mean, in the movie, it's really just an excuse to give Mark Wahlberg a silly haircut and have some sort of gaudy decorations on the walls in the homes. But it doesn't add to the story in any way. And
turned into Ghost at one. You know, it was like instead of Patrick Swayze, it was Mark Wahlberg. You know, the whole windows. And I'm like,
yeah.
It's just that sometimes when you think, I hate movies that are trying to be realistic, and I know we have dream sequences and fantasy stuff going on in this film. It's just that when the afterlife and the current life kind of bridge, like in Ghost with the penny and all that kind of stuff.
Right.
It's just I'd rather think that she's there in spirit, but she can't make contact, like breathing on the glass. And I'm
right.
It just at that point I was like, well, okay, this movie's just not. It's just going to be a free-for-all.
Yeah.
You know?
And there's a sequence later in the film even which is much more clear where she comes in. She sort of inhabits somebody's body, which
ghost.
Is really very
another
ghost-like.
Ghost,
yes, exactly.
Ghost-like.
And that to me was like the low point of the film where it was just really, really sappy and I don't know.
I think it didn't keep my interest.
And it's long.
Yeah,
it's over 2 hours long.
It's very long. But I tell you what, one reason to see this movie is Stanley Tucci. I mean, I think he delivers a very disturbing performance.
Yeah.
And, here's a guy I associate with comedies.
You know,
I love The Imposters. I think he's a brilliant writer and a brilliant director and a brilliant actor. And I love The Core, he's in. But all it takes is just some weird teeth to put on.
Right,
and
the comb-over haircut.
Made me very uncomfortable.
Yeah, he does a good job. I mean, it's kind of a standard serial killer-esque performance, I think. I mean, it's the kind of thing that's obviously built on stuff like Hannibal Lecter and other creepy serial killer performances. But it is effective. I just think it doesn't necessarily even fit within this movie because, like we're saying, there's a lot of sort of Trapper Keeper, Lisa Frank, rainbow sentiment going on here.
Right, and the performance is diluted because of all the special effects and all the way the movie's pulling you in like four or five different directions.
Yeah.
It didn't seem to be very focused.
No.
Yeah, so maybe he was trying to appease the readers or the author, or I don't know what he was doing. So
I don't know either, and I don't know if he does. And it's too bad because I think Peter Jackson is excellent. And he made a movie before the Lord of the Rings films, before he was a big deal, called Heavenly Creatures with Kate Winslet, right, which is great and is about it's a true true crime story.
I'm a frightened fan, you know. So
yeah.
In fact, the only chance I had, I spoke to him twice for the Lord of the Rings films, and I mentioned finally, I had to do it. I'm like, why'd you kill Arlie Ermey? You know, the drill instructor from. Why did you kill him in The Frighteners? It always bothered me, and I can't remember the answer he gave me, but I mean,
not a satisfactory answer.
No, it wasn't. but I think The Frighteners is one of the most perfect, you know.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I think Peter Jackson, like Sam Raimi, started out making these really sort of small, scrappy films that were.
Shallow Grave? Did he do that? No, he didn't.
No. That's Danny Boyle.
That was Danny Boyle.
Yeah, but I mean, he did Dead Alive and The Frighteners and Heavenly Creatures and Bad Taste and a lot of these small things, and I think. Like Sam Raimi, it might be good for him to go back to something on a smaller scale.
Definitely.
And this is just, it just doesn't work.
Well, there was so much anticipation for this film, so much buzz around this film, so much push by the studios. And again, it's just, I don't know who to recommend this film to. And it wasn't fulfilling. It was kind of forgettable.
I don't recommend this film really to anybody, I don't think, unless you're just a Peter Jackson completist. So I would give it 2 out of 5 stars. I just don't think it's really worth seeing.
I agree. Wait for video. It's a good pay-per-view thing.
I mean,
but
if you're
still
if you're
too long, people. I don't think people will stay through the whole thing.
No, there's nothing holding your attention. There's one suspenseful sequence towards the end, I think, with the main character's sister, and she's trying to find out the truth. And anyway, I don't want to give too much away, but
the movie can't decide what it wants to be. It's like 10 different movies in one, and you're trying to scratch your head, going, "What is going on?"
Right.
You know, so. Yeah,
no,
it's going to just be forgotten.
Easily missed, unfortunately. So also opening this week is a movie that may get some awards attention, which is A Single Man, directed by Tom Ford, the fashion designer, and this is his first film. It's with Colin Firth as a gay college professor in 1960s Los Angeles who is mourning the death of his longtime lover, but of course, this being 1962, he can't exactly do any of that openly.
Publicly display.
So exactly. I mean, can't even reveal his relationship having existed. So it's a movie about repression and about sort of pushing down your feelings and how the sort of surface stuff that this guy does, his very impeccable dressing and his nicely appointed home and stuff like that, is a way for him to hide his inner self. Which sounds really interesting, but it doesn't quite come across, I don't think, in this film. Colin Firth is a good actor, and it's nice to see him do a part that really offers him a lot, because he does a lot of those Bridget Jones's boyfriend kind of roles. Right. And
he's always the lover, that you see, the safe guy, you know, that always comes into the rescue, or just the love interest.
Right, which is kind of dull and doesn't offer him a lot of range. And here he does a good job. I mean, and he's the one really that it seems like is getting the attention here and might get a Best Actor nomination at the Oscars. And I think it would be well-deserved, but the movie as a whole I don't think holds up. It's very surfacey itself. I mean, it looks like it's directed by a fashion designer. It's very perfume commercial looking. And despite the efforts to make that visual style kind of like connect with what the story is about, I don't think it quite works. I think if this was like a short film that was just about sort of impressions, it might be effective. But when you're trying to delve into a character and delve into a story, it just doesn't hold up over the course of a feature. So disappointing, but it still has, again, a strong performance. Julianne Moore is also in it, who kind of goes a little overboard with her drunken.
So Colin is going to be remembered maybe Oscar time.
I think it's entirely possible. Yeah, I mean, I don't know if he'll win an Oscar for this, but I think he could get a nomination. And I think it's good again that it shows that he can do this sort of serious, dramatic role and carry the film, and not just play somebody's boyfriend or husband or whatever. So. Yeah, maybe worth a DVD rental. Probably not something to rush out and see. But if you like Colin Firth, this is definitely a chance for him to shine. So I appreciated that. And speaking of awards, Jeff will be in Los Angeles this weekend. Is that right?
Yes, I'm leaving Friday afternoon. I'm going to Los Angeles for the Broadcast Film Critics Awards that I'm a member of the BFCA.
Right.
Yeah, it's broadcast on the ever-popular VH1 again this year. And what's her name?
Is it Kristen Chenoweth is the host?
Yeah, she's hosting it. So.
Do you get to present an award?
You know, it's funny. About 2 years ago, we did present for Best Picture. We didn't have a host. And so we all got up on stage, all the critics.
Are there like
all
hundreds
of yeah,
people?
Yeah, it was packed. It was packed. You should have seen people during the commercial break trying to, you know, adjust their position to get to the front and you'd be seen. And I was on the very end, but you didn't see me. But yeah, but this year it's going to be, it should be a lot of fun. And
yeah.
We're in a new location. And so I'm going to be going out and do that. It's the first major award season present, you know, show of the year.
Right.
And follows the Golden Globes and it precedes the Golden Globes. So yeah, it should be pretty fun. It's always crazy, you know.
Right.
You know, it's funny. I've gone to this show now for like 10 plus years, and you know, this is the first year I'm like, I just want to stay home. You know,
you don't want to put on, do you wear a tux?
Yeah, I do. I wear a tuxedo, and I did last year. I bought one. Man, it cost me an arm and a leg, but I bought one because I just felt always underdressed because I would go there in a nice suit and stuff, but still my colleagues and people would, you know, I meet all the stars that are nominated and everything, and I just felt like underdressed. So
yeah.
I did buy me a tuxedo and just finished paying it off after a year. But so that'll be pretty exciting. But yeah, watch that tomorrow on VH1, and
yeah.
We'll see how that goes.
Definitely. See if you can spot Jeff somewhere
the back,
there,
yeah.
Maybe.
I might be there. If you can see me, I'll put it on my DVR, and if I find it, I'll let you know where you can see me if you freeze it. So.
And you're pulling for The Hurt Locker to win the top prize.
You know,
there.
It's funny. That and Precious were the two films I've kept, you know, going back and forth with which was the best of the year. But
yeah,
you know, as much as I love Precious, I've seen that like four or five times. Such an absolute incredible film. Hurt Locker just was an amazing film.
Yeah.
Too. So, and yeah, I'm pulling for Hurt Locker in all categories. So that's my movie this year.
Yeah, definitely. No, I'm with you, man. I think I've talked about Hurt Locker on the last like three episodes of this podcast. I mentioned it last week. It's just out on DVD. Just a couple days ago.
A lot of people still haven't seen it. You
right.
Know, I would say, what do they ask me? What's that? I go, Hurt Locker. What's that about?
Is there people that really are not aware of it?
No, they're
that's
not.
That's amazing.
And now
yeah.
It's on DVD. It's great
because
I can say that. And now, you know, hopefully it'll get some Academy Award nominations or even win. And it'll start doing well on DVD. So.
Yeah. I mean, it's a movie that I think people should definitely see. And
I'm one of the last people that love these. You know, these about Iraq, and I just don't, you know, I watch the news enough. I'm not interested in those kind of movies.
Right. There are so many that were done really poorly.
You know, Three Kings were the last one, you know, that I was somewhat interested in. But,
yeah.
You know, I haven't watched, you know, anything of the HBO specials or the miniseries. Like, I just don't want to be reminded of that. You
yeah.
know, I know they're probably really good, but Hurt Locker.
Well, a lot of them really weren't really
no,
good.
No, they weren't. I just, you know, I'm one of those anti-war people, you know, so, but for the Hurt Locker, it wasn't about the conflict.
It's about characters.
It was
yeah.
The personal story of this guy and
yeah.
the bomb disposal. And that just, you know, it wasn't a band of guys going out shooting people, and you know, it was totally different.
Right.
So it was a different perspective, and I thought that was it worked very well.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think it's a very well done film, and a lot of times you get to the end of the year, and the movies that end up sort of rising to the top, I feel like, oh man, this is it. This mediocrity is going to end up winning all these awards.
Yeah.
But I don't think that. I mean, this wasn't my pick for the best movie of the year, but at the same time, I think it's one of the best, and I would be happy to see it win.
The traps of cliches.
No.
You could have had those characters, those soldiers that you see in every movie, and I thought, wow, it didn't have that at all. It played it very real.
Yeah.
You know, so Kathryn Bigelow did an excellent job. So,
absolutely.
Yeah.
And if people haven't seen it, it's available on DVD now, and I think you're going to be hearing a lot more about it in the next few weeks as the Golden Globes happen this weekend and Oscar nominations come out, and I think it's gonna be
busy time.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, if people aren't aware of it, yes, they'll definitely get aware of it. So, but there are and also just to wrap up in terms of what's out in theaters now.
Daybreakers,
yes.
Yeah,
this is right. Jeff is dying to talk about Daybreakers.
It's because it's the first movie I paid like 3 years. I've actually went and paid. I went to Texas Station, and first of all, real quick, I'm appalled by the amount of commercials that we have to sit through.
It's true. You and I are lucky because we go to these media screenings and we don't have
you don't
to do
see
that.
Those,
yeah.
I mean, there were 30 minutes of being bombarded. I don't mind a cool Coke commercial every now and then, but we're bombarded by all of these ads. I felt trapped, and then the movie didn't start for a good 20 minutes with all the trailers and everything
right.
going on. So, man, you're talking, I cannot believe how long it took just to get to the stupid movie. You know,
yes.
It wasn't stupid.
No.
Daybreakers was a great premise. If you love vampires,
it's a great premise. I thought it was somewhat botched in the execution, but it is a great premise.
It did kind of fall apart towards the end, you know, because it just kind of wrapped things up. But I wish it was a little bit, you know, they left it open. You know, I sat there and I thought to myself, well, I don't want to give, I'll tell you off the air. but what I thought was going to happen, and it didn't happen. But what's cool is that, you know, it's a great twist on a traditional story that the vampires are now farming humans that were an endangered species, and they're trying to get a blood substitute. And Mark Wahlberg.
Ethan Hawke.
Ethan
Hawke. Not Mark Wahlberg.
Ethan Hawke is a blood scientist. You know, everybody has turned for one reason or another. You know, not
right.
because they want to be vampires, they have they're sick or whatever. And Sam Neill runs this big pharmaceutical drug company that wants it. So I thought it was just a great premise that
it is a great premise.
Humans
yeah.
are dying out, and the vampires are not going to be killed. And now, as the longer they don't have blood, the more they mutate into these
They look like Nosferatu. They look like Max Shrek.
Underground dwellers. I mean, it was a very, very well executed film. And the final sequence, you know, where the soldiers were feeding off each other. I mean, do you remember that image? It was just
I felt like
Matrix X, you know?
Yeah, so. I mean, that was the problem. I felt like it's got a great premise and it had a great setup. And for the first, like, half hour, 40 minutes, I was like, wow, this movie is really clever. Mm-hmm. And it has a nice look to it. The Spierig brothers, the Australians who directed this film.
It was all dark and kind of cloudy, the lighting on it. And it was all very, you know, it felt like you lived in a world of darkness.
Right, and they created a good, like, a world that felt like it was internally consistent, and the opening credits, and I always like movies with good opening credit sequences, and it gives you a sense of, like, what this world is really quickly. But I just felt like after that, it degenerated into this sort of, like, generic action movie-ish kind of thing. And once Willem Dafoe, and I love Willem Dafoe, but once he shows up as the sort of underground freedom fighter guy, the movie to me kind of lost track of what it was. And I don't know, it's a great premise, and I think it's certainly better than, like, Twilight or something. I mean, I'd rather see a vampire movie like this. But at the same time, I felt like it didn't quite follow through the way I hoped it would.
And you know, it's from Screen Gems, so it was a low budget. It wasn't like...
Well, yeah, but you still want it to be, I mean...
Sure, sure. I mean, it did have some flaws. I mean, the whole Sam Neill and his relationship with his daughter...
Yeah,
I mean,
that was no kind of secondary. Yeah, no, that was, you know, it's a little,
like,
ridiculous.
Even her resolution was, I'm like, what? I mean, some things that I thought, well, I just kept saying to myself, okay, these guys, you know, they've written themselves in some corners here, and it just wasn't executed. But overall, I thought it was a really good B-horror film.
I mean, it was certainly better than you would expect of a movie like this at this time of year. So I will say that.
And if you like vampires, which is hot right now, I think it delivers.
It's definitely a different kind of vampire movie. Right. So that's cool. And I would recommend seeing Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus.
I had a blast with that. I'm a Terry Gilliam fan and Heath Ledger's last film. And I love how they hired everybody else to fill in his, you know, other Jude Law and Colin Farrell.
Johnny Depp. Yeah.
And it worked.
It did.
It absolutely worked.
It surprisingly did.
Yeah. And I love it.
So yeah, so the Heath Ledger thing, the replacement with the various actors, I think, yeah, it works surprisingly well. You wouldn't expect that.
And
to...
I've been a Terry Gilliam fan since I was a little boy from Monty Python too. I think Brazil is one of the greatest movies ever made, and I have the making of the book of Brazil, that if you ever wanted to read all what happened with that, and I have the Criterion Collection of Brazil, but I like the American version I do than the his cut. It didn't make much sense, but it seems that digital cinema is made for Terry Gilliam now. I mean,
right. He can just let his imagination run wild,
because he used to do stuff that, you know, full scale effects, and I just thought, wow, just how complicated and had, but now he's just made for digital effects. So yeah, Dr. Parnassus was just, and Christopher Plummer was just,
yeah, he's excellent. I mean, at you know, he's still going really strong at 80 years old or whatever. Christopher
again,
Plummer,
another difficult film to kind of pitch people with Heath Ledger, you know, because it's such an experimental kind of, you know, if you don't know Terry Gilliam, you're just like, what is going on? Because I took some friends and like, what is going on?
Yeah,
you know, they weren't prepared for something like
but
that.
But it's an entertaining film. I think you can
very
see
Ray
it and
just very Something Wicked This Way Comes and Granter of Dreams and then also Devil and Daniel Webster. I mean, it's just it's some really classic stories kind of melded together, but very enjoyable.
Absolutely, a lot of fun. So check those out in theaters. Daybreakers and The Imaginarium of Dr. Parnassus are out now.
While you can.
while you're right, yeah. Those may be short-lived, but they're certainly out now. So check those out. And The Hurt Locker on DVD, I think. If people haven't seen that, that's one absolutely to check out.
We're off to a good start for 2010.
There you go. So my thanks to Jeffrey K. Howard for joining me this week.
Thank you, Mr. Bell.
And for Las Vegas Weekly, I'm Josh Bell.